I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, David and Hannah talk us through some of the most exciting titles to look forward to in 2024. It's the subject of the new issue, Poor Things, and Hannah spoke to the Icons Only crew of Mark Ruffalo, Rami Youssef, and Willem Dafoe. Then it's Sofia Coppola's complex portrait, Priscilla, and I got to speak to its cinematographer, Philippe Lesourd, about the film. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Happy New Year to you both and to all the listeners. Hopefully a slightly less cursed one than last year. No strikes, though some other bad stuff is happening, so it's not all good.
Yeah, I don't think it's never not... I kind of feel that we're in a place where it's never not going to be, like, fully unbad in the world. But that's being glib about the state of things. But, you know, we can only pray for a good one, really.
Yeah, I did read a very depressing interview with someone where they said that after the Second World War, the subject of many, many films, the idea of like re-entering war was just like considered absolutely impossible. And now we live in a state where the idea of there not being a war on seems like absolutely impossible. God, this is such a gloomy entrance. But yes, at least we have the movies to distract ourselves. So should we start with Hannah? Do you want to talk us through some of your most exciting titles that you're looking forward to seeing?
Yeah, so the highlight of my year, or one of the highlights of my year, I should say, every year is putting together our end of year preview for the next year, which takes me a lot of time and is very stressful. And it's a lot of work. So if you've read it, thank you, because it genuinely does take me a lot of time and I take it very seriously. But it gives me a nice, you know, a nice period where I'm just kind of looking forward and looking for projects that have been shot that maybe I didn't know about, or projects that have moved forward and development, which have been kind of on the back burner for a long time. It's kind of a nice way of me checking in with how the industry's doing, which we don't always get a chance to do on the kind of day-to-day. So there's lots coming down the pipeline that I'm very excited about. The Iron Core is out in a few weeks, which I think is just a wonderful film by Sean Durkin about the Von Erich family, a kind of tragic wrestling dynasty, and we'll be covering that one on the podcast, so I'm not going to say too much more about it. There's a film coming out called Bring the Down, which is a first-time British filmmaker, and it is about a farming family who come into kind of conflict with another neighbouring family, and that stars Barry Keoghan and Christopher Abbott. So that's, you know, very exciting times. Two of my boys, and I mean, obviously, I can't wait for the new Bong Joon-ho, can't wait for the new Francis Ford Coppola. I think that potentially this could be, we say it every year, but it could be an all-timer Cannes lineup because there's just so much kind of exciting stuff coming down the pipeline. Maybe a new Terrence Malick film. We say that every year, but maybe this year will be
maybe
the year.
A new Lynch film. Who knows?
Maybe a new Lynch film. Yeah. So yeah, there's tons of stuff. I mean, even like Sundance starts in a few weeks, and I'm very excited for the new Rose Glass film, Love Lies Bleeding. I'm lucky enough to. I don't know how much we can say about what we've seen, some stuff that's coming in the next few months, and there's some very fun stuff already kind of due in the first. I'm trying to be oblique. I don't want to get like sued by any distributors, but there's some good stuff already coming down the chute, which is good because, you know, in January, February, it's such a kind of gloomy time of the year. You need something to look forward to. This month, traditionally, although we're talking about two very good films today. It's not always the strongest period for cinematic releases. And then kind of looking further ahead, I'm very excited for The Beast, which I think we talked a little bit about on the Venice podcast. I can't remember.
I believe there was a chant of beast, beast, beast.
That sounds like something we would do. I'm so happy that's got distribution, because Bonello's last film, Coma, I don't think did get distribution here. I don't think it got distribution anywhere. So it's nice that it's been picked up. It's a very, very good film, and that's out in May over here. I mean, as always, you know, there's a lot of kind of fun, interesting stuff coming. It's you know, I as much as I like shit talk the film industry, you know, this does kind of give me hope that there's still loads of interesting films getting made and hopefully coming out in cinemas, if cinemas still exist in like 6 months time, who knows.
Well, one thing that we'd normally be getting excited for but doesn't really exist anymore is virtual Sundance, which would normally be something that was coming around the corner and we were going to sit on our laptops and use their fantastic online platform. Sadly, that has sort of gone by the wayside in this post-pandemic world. But anything at Sundance that you're particularly excited for?
Well, Love Lies Bleeding will be there, but I won't get to see that because that's not online. I'm not going in person because it's many, many thousands of pounds, which no one has unless they're rich or work for a huge magazine. There's a couple of smaller things. There's a film called Thelma, starring June Squibb as this elderly lady who gets her kind of own back on a scammer who steals her life savings, which I'm excited to watch. And there's another film with Kristen Stewart and Steven Yeun about... Now, the way it's described, I don't quite know what it's going to be like. It's about a boy and a satellite who fall in love, but they're humans, but they're not, they're technology. I don't know, it sounds like Her, and I love Her, so you know, I'm into this kind of inanimate objects falling in love with each other thing. I don't know, sounds like a Sundance film, sounds interesting. And then there's this film, Between the Temples, with Jason Schwartzman and Carol Kane, which is about a rabbi who ends up teaching his former school teacher who is converting to Judaism like later in life. And it just, yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of odd and lovely, and yeah, I have no idea kind of what to expect. Sundance is that festival of kind of discovery. It sounds really lame, but you know, it's where I saw The Souvenir, and I remember like going into that with kind of quite middling expectations. The same with something like Minari, which I remember seeing and just been so kind of blown away by. So you know, even though the online offering is very sparse this year, and I have a lot of thoughts about that I will not express on this podcast because we already have a lot to talk about today, but yeah, hopefully there'll be some good stuff to come out of it. Of course, Berlin Film Festival is next month, which I'm sure is going to be like jam-packed. There's a film playing actually at Berlin called Cuckoo, which I'm very excited to see, with Hunter Schafer. So yeah, there's tons I'm excited about, almost kind of too much for me to comprehend. There's too much good cinema, as Barry Jenkins once said.
David, what about you? Anything you're particularly excited for that's going to be imminently released?
Yeah, Hannah covered many, many bases there, so I'll try and pick a few like tinier things. One thing I'm really looking forward to is a film called Grand Tour by a Portuguese filmmaker called Miguel Gomez. And he did a film called Taboo, and he did a film called Arabian Nights, which way, way, way back when we put on the cover. And he did a little kind of doodly pandemic film as well, which was the last thing he released. And he's had this kind of grand historical war epic that he's been making for years and years and years, and it was going to be made in Mexico, then it was going to be made in Argentina, and then I think it's moved elsewhere now. But from what I hear, it's done and dusted and is going to be coming to hopefully a festival. So I guess we'll see where that pops up. But yeah, he's one of my faves. I'm looking forward to that. Also looking forward to a film called The Nickel Boys. I'm not entirely sure when that's going to turn up, but it's by a filmmaker called Ramel Ross, who did a film called Hale County this evening, which was just a really incredible, like sort of ethereal documentary. And this is his take on the novel that Colson Whitehead wrote as the follow-up to Underground Railroad. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how that turns out, him doing a kind of more, I guess, straight fiction film. And lastly, I think on a more sort of genre bent, I'm looking forward to the new film by Alice Lowe, who did a kind of like feminist horror film called Prevenge a couple of years back, where a woman is experiencing a kind of malevolent force from her kind of unborn child. It's sort of like The Omen, but kind of pre-birth. She's got a new film that feels like it's been a long time coming, but she tweeted in January that it's definitely going to be this year. It's called Time Stalker. And it's kind of got, it's sort of like a sort of dating time travel. I'm sure it's going to have some sort of nasty edge to it with the word stalker in the title. But like, I'm sure it's going to be very funny. Like Nick Frost's in it. And yeah, I'm just excited to see what she's been up to. I like that little kind of the Garth Marenghi set. And, you know, I like to keep tabs on all the things that they've been doing. So yeah, I'm really, really excited for that one.
Oh, that sounds like that would make an amazing double bill with The Beast in terms of like, time-traveling men that are best avoided.
And women not able to catch a break in any timeline. Also, we should also mention, since it's on topic, Yorgos Lanthimos will have another film probably coming out. Well, if not coming out, at least at a festival this year. His second in as many years, Kind of Kindness, formerly titled And. I mean, Kind of Kindness, I think, also is a weird title. But yeah, this is his reunion with Efimis Philippou, who co-wrote The Lobster and Dogtooth and Alps and Killing of a Sacred Deer. He's kind of his Greek collaboration partner. Tony McNamara been his like Australian collaboration partner. So I'm excited for that.
Oh yeah, I mean, no time like the present. I too am very excited to him returning to being a little bit nastier, but maybe that's just because of the 2023 I had. But yeah, let's get into his latest. It's Poor Things.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Bella Baxter is a young woman brought back to life by an unorthodox scientist, Dr. Godwin Baxter. Under Godwin and his protege's Maxford's protection, Bella is eager to learn. Hungry for the worldliness she is lacking, Bella runs off with debauched lawyer Duncan Wedderburn on a whirlwind adventure across the continents. Sexually curious and free from the prejudices of her time, Bella slowly finds her purpose. But first up, Hannah spoke to Mark Ruffalo, Rami Youssef, and Willem Dafoe, who played Duncan Wedderburn, Max, and Dr. Goodwin, respectively.
First of all, could you talk to me about your first experiences of Yorgos Lanthimos' filmography and your reaction to that, I guess? The appeal of working with him for both of you.
Yeah, you know that one.
Okay. I think what I saw first was Dogtooth, and then after I started looking at other stuff, and I've gone back to his films. And I think it's worth noting that his early films are quite different than these films. I mean, not only are they they aren't English language films, they're also structured differently. They have a different kind of narrative, and of course, they aren't period films. But they just interested me. And every time I see a movie that touches on some things that excite me, or engage me, you get curious about the filmmaker. So I followed it. And then when he made The Favorite, I thought, wow, you know, he made Killing the Sacred Deer too, but he's making English language films. And The Favorite with that period feel, when he proposed this to me, it was like, of course, of course. But it's interesting how I've done a film with him after as well, and it's more like his early films. So
that's very exciting to me.
It's not like implying a development there's not a hierarchy to these films. He's just an incredible filmmaker, and he was great to be around. Inspiring.
And for you, Mark, what was the kind of first experience you had of his
work? It was Killing of the Sacred Deer, and then Lobster, and then Favorite, of course. And then went back to Dogtooth and some of the earlier stuff. Yeah, I mean, what was remarkable to me was that he can move so easily between different kind of genres and styles. But one thing that was stuck out was how great the acting was and how great performances he would get from his actors.
Well, I was going to ask like how your experience was working as a director, but I think since I have 3 minutes left, I will ask about Emma instead, because she's such a powerhouse in this film, and I know their collaborations just consistently kind of incredibly exciting to me as a film lover. Mm-hmm. For you guys, as you kind of most of your scenes in the film are with her, how would you kind of describe her as a scene partner, as a kind of collaborator?
Fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah. And she's also, she's at the center, and she was at, Yorgos brought her in very early, and Yorgos is involved with all aspects of production, as was Emma. So when we arrive, it's really about working with them, working for them, really help to realize what they've been working on for a long time. But she's very cool, very practical, has great skill, and it's fun to be around. No hierarchies, no diva behavior. She's a lot of fun.
Yeah, she's such a generous partner, and just so present and game, you know, totally willing and fearless, and obviously just so gifted, and just one of the great, this is a instant classic performance.
She's a really hard worker, but there's something totally easy about her.
Her laugh is the most beautiful, funny, infectious laugh in the world, too.
I mean, watching the film, you do get a sense that this must have been an incredibly fun set to be on.
Fantastic.
It was amazing.
And I know in kind of pre-production, William, you and Rami did what has been described to me as mortuary school by Yorgos. Very curious to know what this was exactly.
Well, a woman that worked at the morgue came and taught us how to cut and flay, and told us some things about doing autopsies, and we worked with the period instruments, and we learned how to do sutures and that sort of thing. And we do a little bit of that in the movie. That's not really the reason. It's as much to give us a period.
A bonding experience.
Yeah.
Will you accept to not be a part of this?
Absolutely not. Creatures. We wouldn't let him near that
stuff.
They
weren't even, they were
the
very
window.
Stingy.
We wouldn't let him get near our chunks of meat that we were sewing together.
Did you guys end up eating that?
No.
Okay.
I don't eat meat.
That's right.
But for you, there's no kind of dastardly rogue school that you can go to and study kind of how to...
No, there is somewhere, I'm sure.
In Berlin.
What did your kind of preparation entail? Because, I mean, this is a very different performance for you. I greatly enjoy seeing you get to do something very left field and very, very funny.
Not as much as me. thank you. You know, we had a three-week rehearsal process. You could, the writing was just so wild, and I could tell what it had to be. And then, you know, Yorgos was really pushing me in the direction of kind of physicality. And I found a lot of that character in that, the costume, you know, the dancing, you know, just the style of it. You could tell it wasn't naturalism. We had to push it out. Otherwise, it would have just fallen flat. So that was my bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much, as you're saying, in his early work, it's there as well. The style is kind of, it gives you the framework, I guess, for everything else, for the performance.
Yeah, which is his theater work, you know. You do theater and you're just working in so many different styles.
Also, he started, my understanding, his first filming was, he was filming dance.
Yeah.
He's really a polymath. I mean, he knows a lot about many different disciplines. He knows about dance. He knows about architecture. He's got a deep understanding.
Photography.
Love for music. He's incredible.
When I was talking to him, like the references he's pulling out, I'm like, this is incredible.
And that's, like, who is and that's, this guy?
And that's, yeah, and that's
Orson Welles.
Being with him, that's the big turn on.
Yeah.
Because he's connected to many beautiful things.
And then at any moment, he'd run in. He'd be like, let's do one. And then they'd run in with like, an 8x10 photo a camera, and he'd be under the hood, you know, and you'd have to stand really still, and he was shooting plate film during the course of the whole movie.
Just for like takes
on
set.
Yeah, and then on his days off, he's in the dark room.
Oh my God.
And he'd show up with these beautiful prints.
A lot of on-set photos.
He'll
just say, come here, and you'll go off in a corner, and you'll do a little impromptu photo session.
Yeah.
Especially when you've got the gorgeous sets as well.
We were shooting on those sets. He was shooting his, large format camera. It was amazing. It was such a great experience.
need to tell him that we want a photo book of like all.
He's making a photo book of all
I'm
of
so
it.
So happy to hear this.
It's really cool. The photos are amazing.
Final thing, congratulations on the accents in this film. Really good work as a British person, and I can say like, I know Scottish, but yeah, I wanted to kind of ask very quickly what your like secret is, if there is a secret to doing a kind of a British Scottish accent, or is it just like a lot of like repetition and
I had to start like a couple months before working with Neil Swain, our dialect coach.
I worked with that same dialect coach, and I looked at videos of Alistair Gray, not really, you know, following that, but getting a flavor from how he spoke. But I think accents, it depends on what kind of performance is, what kind of film it is, because sometimes it's better not to be a good student and do them exactly and kind of do them in your imagination. They're more flexible sometimes. They may not be totally authentic, but sometimes they fly. And then other times it's really important to, you know, not have any wonky sounds coming out of you. So you got to judge each time, I think.
Especially with Yorgos, it's, you know, everything is a kind of fantasy. It's, you know, yeah, 10 you, times
you got
bigger.
A little room to move.
Yes.
As Mark says, who says he's English? Maybe he isn't. Maybe that's a put
maybe
on
Doug
accent.
Had, I think Duncan Lederberg is actually a total fraud.
Bad on you for making certain kind of assumptions. You're going to judge him on your assumptions?
She said I had a good accent. I'm not going to argue with that.
I mean, I come in this room. I try and have a nice conversation.
And we try to be nice, too.
They just totally attack me.
It's a little difficult for us.
Yeah, it's hard for us to be nice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, I'm really going through it, and I've been separated.
Just lonely, you know?
Yeah, incredibly. But I think they felt that I was built for it. You
yeah,
know? Because I think Mark or Willem alone.
Yeah, I mean, the know, guy, no one yeah, wants that. Like,
no one would be. Their first interest level's low, and then composure. They both have composure issues.
They so. Need each other to keep like in check. Like that's the thing.
Well, I think that was the thinking, and then it's somehow even worse.
It's worse.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
much worse.
Yeah. I think that's been the general feedback.
Yeah, everyone coming in, they're like, oh god, like, you know,
oh my god,
that's
these
the
guys
worst
are out
time.
Of their mind. Yeah.
Okay, first question: can you tell me your first encounter with Yorgos' work and what kind of drew you to him as a director?
I think it was The Lobster. Although I know I watched Dogtooth right around the same time, so I don't remember which I saw first. But I think I saw The Lobster first. I think I was just immediately drawn in by how funny it was, you know, and I remember, especially with Dogtooth, watching it with people and people being kind of weirded out, and I'm just laughing the whole time. And I think I was really drawn to the way that, like, to me, all comedy is bringing subconscious to the conscious realm, and I think he does it in a way that is so visceral that it hits in a lot of different ways, and it can create a feeling that can be unsettling. For me, unsettling is funny, and so I've always been just such a big fan. And when I found out he wanted to talk to me, it was crazy.
That must have been surreal.
Definitely. Even just having a Zoom with him was surreal, you know, and then getting to be on set was a whole other story, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, I find him a very good litmus test for people. Like, if, you know, I'm talking to someone about his movies and they're like, oh, yeah, I love him, I'm like,
yeah,
okay, we'll probably be okay together,
yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
I heard you went to mortuary school with Willem Dafoe, which he then explained was just a woman who came in and told you how to do things with bodies.
Yes.
How that sounds like a dream of mine, learning how to do medical stuff with Willem Dafoe. I think
yes.
I've had that dream. How was that for you? Was that I imagine, again, that must have been a strange kind of thing to go from this world of, you know, doing TV and doing stand-up to suddenly you're learning how to do sutras with one of the greatest character actors of all time.
Of all time. Yeah, I mean, I would love to do all medical things with Willem Dafoe. I think if I ever need to do a procedure, even like basic drawing of the blood, I would like Willem to be there.
You feel very safe with him.
Yeah, I feel safe. I feel like he has a good handle of the medical industry. I think the tone he brings to it is refreshing. You know, it was very fun to get to have that time with him.
And I know that Yorgos is very kind of exacting in his kind of references and things he's drawing from. Did he give you any kind of, oh, you should watch this film, you should look at these kind of paintings, you know, whatever? I'm very curious in kind of what direction he gives you when you're prepping.
He had sent me this kind of like watercolor photo of a guy that he thought was a bit of a style reference for Max, who kind of does look like me a bit, but not really. But there was something there. And, you know, we were talking about just beard length and hair length and that kind of stuff at one point. And otherwise, it was kind of all in the script. You know, I think what we cultivated in rehearsals and kind of how free everyone got with each other, he's so great because he doesn't really over talk too much. I think he asked me to do it because he wanted my handle on what it was going to be tonally. I think it was kind of like a tone thing. And I think when I first met him, we talked about tone and he talked about the tone of my show and he had seen my stand up. And so I think we had kind of had an alignment on that. And I took it to be a comedy straight up. So I was, you know, I know how to do that.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Obviously, like, I mean, I want to kind of ask you about that because, you know, your background is comedy, writing, producing, you know, you had your own show. And I know since you've shot Poor Things, you directed an episode of The Bear. So, like, you know, obviously you're someone who kind of, I guess, must approach something like this from having all that kind of different experience. And I'm curious to know how much you feel you learned about writing, maybe directing, from like working with Yorgos.
Yeah, I took in a lot. I mean, I think I was really impressed with the way that he's so detail oriented, but he still lets us organically do, you know, he's not a control freak, or I mean, he is, but he's really good at hiding it. Like he knows what he wants, but he still lets it breathe. Mm. And I think that balance is what makes something masterful. Everything is thought out. You know, it's so clear he's worked with the set designers, the costume designers really, really closely, but at the same time, let them do their own thing. And it's the same thing with the actors. He's going to work really closely and say what he wants, but still let you do your own thing. And I think that balance was very reaffirming to see done at such a high level. Mm. Because I think I feel an organic connection to that, to kind of having, you know, a real clear idea of what I want, but still kind of letting the vibe be it. And sometimes I would be like, should I be like more precise? But then you watch Yorgos work and you're like, no, there's something to that balance of actually letting things be. And so it felt very exciting to see him, you know, do that so well.
And you feel like you've learned from watching him?
Oh, yeah, I've learned a lot from watching him. And yeah, I mean, it's just, I felt inspired.
Oh, good. You know? I mean, I think that's what anyone wants when they work with a director. You know, you want to come away from it, not just having a great, fun time, which it sounds like it was anyway, but you know, come away thinking, oh, I've grown as a human being.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
How does it differ working when you're kind of preparing for a period piece to doing something contemporary?
Well, for me, this was really the first time I was playing something so far from myself, and that was really exciting because it's something I felt like I always could do, but I didn't know when I would do it. And then to have it incoming as opposed to me kind of having to call my agents and be like, I swear I could act, you know, because it's like my show's called Rami, and I play a character called Rami. It's like, you know, yeah, it's like good, and we do what we do, and I'm very proud of it. And I think, but you know, you still kind of think, I don't know if they're going to believe me that I could like do a character. And so to have someone like Yorgos say, no, you could do this was amazing.
I'm curious to know as well, like, so you mentioned tone earlier. Could you maybe talk about that? I'm very curious to know kind of what about your like comedy Yorgos kind of related to. It's fascinating to me. Obviously, as a European, like, your show aired here and, you know, people love it. But it's just really interesting that he kind of saw something in that.
Well, I think there's something about the Mediterranean connection of Yorgos being Greek and me being Egyptian, where I just kind of felt like I understood his sense of humor. Like, I understood the sarcasm, but I also understood the passion. And I think, you know, in terms of, you know, how the film plays, you know, there's a certain level of just commitment and not overdoing the joke. Mm-hmm. But the writing is so clear that you can kind of do a lot with a look, and you can do a lot based off of having the right tension in a relationship. And I think that's the kind of comedy that he, again, does in his way that's just so signature. Mm-hmm. I think the link that I kind of felt was just understanding, oh, I know that you don't need this to be comedy, you know? And so, and I think that's when it's, you know, so funny, when it's just honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thank you very much.
So, David, I mean, this one kind of seems like a bit of a no-brainer, like just the ideal subject for a Little White Lies issue. But what was it about it that kind of convinced you that it was worthy of such an honor?
Well, I mean, you know, on the subject of like bad 2023s, this ending up on the cover of Little White Lies was actually a kind of silver lining of the writer's strike, because it was originally going to be coming out quite a bit earlier, like I think October time in 2023.
It was the week after. It was meant to be the week after. It was September. It was a really early date originally.
We were doing our 100th issue then. So there was kind of like, no films on the cover for this one. You know, we're having to sort of like sweep the boards a little bit. So the writer's strike happened, and then and that meant that Poor Things got pushed back into January. And it was like, oh, perfect timing for us to kind of pick up on that. And Hannah and I had been sort of snuck into a cheeky screening of it in July or something. So we were like, oh my God, how can we align the planets to make this happen? And then the writer's strike essentially did that work for us. But yeah, no, it's, I think we really wanted to do The Favourite as a cover, like way back when, and it didn't work out. So this feels like a nice, we're sort of coming back, you know, covering that base later than we'd anticipated. But yeah, you know, just on the film itself, I mean, there's been so much praise for it now. It's won awards. This weekend, it picked up a load of Golden Globes and it won the top prize at Venice. And I'm sure there'll be more awards incoming in the coming weeks. It's like, you know, picking up lots of critics' prizes. And, you know, I feel that, like, it's not one of those films where I think you see people saying that its success is unjust and undeserved. I mean, it's, you know, it's the feeling I had when I originally saw it was one of thinking, wow, a major studio has backed this film and in the form that we're seeing it. Not only because some of the you know, there is some kind of extreme content in it. I mean, it is an 18 rated film, but like the structure of it as well, the tone of it, the style of the performances, the dialogue, the sets, none of it really screamed like studio picture. It has none of that kind of soft manicuring that often happens when you have a kind of sharkskin suited ponytailed producer on set who is kind of having to thumbs up, thumbs down, all these kind of micromanage and stuff like that. This is very much felt like a kind of a pure unadulterated vision, and it is one of those blank check movies that you get after you've had a big success. And you know, The Favourite was kind of radical in and of itself, but like probably Poor Things takes things to the next level in terms of, you know, how much freedom he's had to play the size of the sandbox he's had to kind of roll around in, and what he's been able to do with these performances. Like, Emma Stone is extraordinary in the film. I think she's always been someone who has been, you know, a draw. You know, she has a kind of movie star quality to her. And in this film, we kind of, to put it lightly, get to see a very new and exciting string to her bow, really.
I mean, I have to say that, like, speaking to the team, as I got to do in Venice, the kind of below the line people, and you've got to speak to Yorgos, and we kind of know some people that worked on this, like, they all seemed quite nervous about how it was going to be received, and quite surprised when I was kind of saying, like, oh no, I think this is the best film I've seen this year. They kind of couldn't believe it. But like, were you surprised at kind of how such a strange, sort of quite explicit film seems to have been like so widely embraced?
Yeah, surprised and delighted, I think. Because, you know, us as film critics, we see a lot of movies, and we see often a lot of weird movies. And, you know, there is that thing of like, wow, this is absolutely great. But like, is anyone who isn't already a film nerd gonna really embrace it. And there's always that thing of like, you know, when you check the Rotten Tomatoes scores and you have like the really high critic rating and then the really low audience rating, and that's how you know you've got like a masterpiece on your hands. And whereas Poor Things, I think I remember us discussing this at Venice, like, it was actually surprising that there was kind of no dissent at the festival. Normally every single film you'll have, you know, kind of a split reaction no matter how brilliant the film is, or there'll be some people going, oh, I didn't like it, you know. But actually the weird thing about Poor Things was even the people that didn't really seem to like it at the festival were like, oh, I can totally appreciate the film, it's just maybe not for me, which is a kind of a rare thing to see. And I think we were a bit like, when are we going to get the people coming out who ardently hate this film? And there have been a few, I will say, since its festival run. But it's really lovely and kind of heartening to see a film as strange and lewd as this be kind of embraced by so many people, and not only kind of the Yorgos stans, but also, yeah, just people that love Emma Stone being like, yeah, I really liked it, even though it's not maybe my normal kind of thing. And hopefully, you know, it's the kind of film that someone would watch and then be like, oh, I want to watch more of this guy's stuff. I think it's definitely Yorgos's most accessible film in terms of content and tone, I guess. His older work is a lot meaner and I think a lot more uncomfortable. This is a lot more optimistic, I think. And I that really works for me. I think it's nice to see him work in a kind of different tone and to make something that really reflects its protagonist in such a kind of like joyful way, because Bella Baxter is this, you know, very wide-eyed, very naive, very kind of forthright character in the film. There's been some kind of criticisms around, oh, it's too nice for a Yorgos film, we like it when he's meaner. And I'm like, well, yes, I totally understand that, and I love it when he's kind of a bit of a meanie as well. But also for this film, I think it would have been really heartbreaking to see that happen to a character who is so kind of lovely and so pure and so kind of in love with the world around her. And Emma Stone, when she was accepting her Golden Globe, said she thinks of the film as a romantic comedy because it's about a woman falling in love with life. And I just thought that was such a lovely, sweet way of describing the film, because it is, you know, she sees all the beauty in the world and she sees, you know, great pain and great devastation, and she decides she will challenge the things she can challenge and she will change the things that she thinks need to be changed, but she doesn't become jaded. And I think that maybe that's something I would like to kind of, you know, emulate in myself, retaining that, like, joy at the good things in life. You know, something as simple as eating a pastel di nata, or the kind of scene where she's like she discovers how to dance, which I think is just such a moment of like giddiness within the film. And then, I mean, of course, like the big thing here is like the performances are just so wonderful and so fun. And it's one of those films where, you know, you look at the cast and you watch them and you think they clearly all just had the best time making this film. And I think you feel that as an audience member when you see a film like that. And Mark Ruffalo has been one of my favorite actors for a long time, but I just think he is so good in this film. He is so despicable and so funny and so unafraid to be this like slimy little man. When you meet Duncan Wedderburn, you're like, oh no, he's gonna corrupt her, he's gonna break this girl's heart. I like the way the film kind of wrongfoots you at every turn. You know, it maybe because it's Yorgos, you're expecting all these kind of horrible things to happen. And yeah, I kind of think it's more subversive that actually it's about a woman just having like the time of her life. I think that in this day and age, it's kind of almost more radical for that to happen.
Yeah, I loved how the, you know, a lot of the supporting performances, you have people like Gerard Carmichael or Catherine Hunter that essentially just come along for one part of the journey. And their performances almost seem to be from different films, but it just makes perfect sense because it's all about the world as viewed through Bella's eyes. And so people do seem very different to her as she like learns more about, you know, that maybe like capitalism is bad and there's a thing called the patriarchy, but
like Barbie. Nice.
yes, what did you think of that comparison to Barbie? Actually, some people were saying it about like, oh yeah, this is the year of women with an identity crisis learning hard truths and evolving as people.
Yeah, I think it's a valid comparison. I think I like this more than Barbie, and I really like Barbie, but I think that, I don't know, this maybe feels a bit more sincere, and maybe it is that thing of like, you know, Barbie is ultimately a Mattel toy advert. I mean, it's a great advert and I loved the film and I gave it a very, very positive review, but at the end of the day, it is a toy advert. Whereas this maybe feels a bit more sincere. And I think Yorgos is someone who has such a clear love of art. And I think, to me, the film like reflects that thing of like when you're a kid, you're so open to the world and you're so open to experiences and art and music and people. And you kind of lose that as you get older, especially as a woman. You know, you'd learn to be scared of people and to be wary. And while that is valid in many ways, I think the film's open-armed, like, pursuit of all these different things that Bella discovers, I just think it really reflects that thing that we all desperately try to cling on to, that curiosity. And that, to me, makes it maybe a slightly better take on the coming of age genre than Barbie. But they're both very good films, in my opinion. And I think it's also like, you know, we've kind of hinted at it as, but 2023 wasn't a very good year for many people for many reasons. And I think that I maybe needed some like pure escapism. And this did kind of feel like that in many ways. And I remember like when I spoke to Yorgos for the magazine, I said to him, like, you know, this is the first film you've given a happy ending. And not to spoil it, 'cause it's not really a spoiler, but he kind of laughed and he was like, yeah, well, you know, we spent so much time with this protagonist and we all fell in love with her and we couldn't think of any other way that we would want to end that story. And I think that's just, you know, it's that kind of like fantasy, I think, that really appeals to me, this idea of like, we can't have that happy ending in real life. No one kind of gets that happy ending. And so, yeah, maybe sometimes it's nice that the film gets that thing that none of us actually get in real life. I don't know. I think the film has reminded me what a kind of hopeless romantic I am, which is like very funny considering the film we're about to talk about after this. But yeah, I just think it's not only incredibly delightful to watch, it's just when you unpick it, like, you know, you talking to all the craftspeople, just the level that they're working at and their imagination and the way that Yorgos is able to bring all that creativity together in such a like cohesive way where it doesn't feel like anything is kind of competing for your attention. It all just like works like a symphony. It's like it is an orchestra you're watching, whether it's, you know, the costume design, the music, it all just kind of comes together in such a cohesive way. And even though it's very different from his earlier films, you can still tell it's the same person behind the camera. And I think that is just what an incredible skill to have, to be able to work at like the micro budget level and then with many, many millions of dollars of budget and not cock it up. Like, you know, just great.
Yeah, it's a film where the details is just, you pick out new ones upon every rewatch. I think I'm on 3, maybe 4 times I've seen it. And every new time I kind of see something in a room, I see a tapestry, I see kind of a coordination of the costumes that just like makes my heart sing. David, before we move on, any like little details about Poor Things that you were enriched by? Apologies for the pun.
Oh, yeah, no, I think it is a film about those little details and you kind of, the way that they have kind of built the world, this kind of impressionistic version of Europe that is kind of inspired by classical painting and steampunk, and the world that it kind of exists in is very, a kind of grab bag of influences, but it's still very convincing and authentic. There is no kind of pastiche there. Like in Portugal, you know, they're in Lisbon. The first stop of Bella and Duncan's tour of Europe is Lisbon. And it's like this weird retro-futurist, sun-bleached wonderland that has cable cars and like, you know, like overhead cable cars and things like that. So it's you know, that stuff's really interesting. You know, some, yeah, as you mentioned, some of the little supporting performances I love. You know, I was really delighted to see the great German actress Hannah Schigula, who hasn't been talked about enough and I feel has been robbed of a supporting best supporting actress performance in her small role as an elder lady of leisure who they meet on a cruise ship, who is very much happy with her life and comfortable with the prospect of death, and gives Bella some of the best kind of philosophical pearls in the film. I think overall, I think, you know, talking about this idea of its sort of connectivity to Lanthimos' previous films, my reaction while watching it was the way it looks and feels is very different, because those early films are very kind of cold and clinical I mean, you know, his interest as a filmmaker is this idea of, I mean, he talks about in the interview, it's all about like the rules of society, how we abide. But also, you know, he is someone who's very interested in psychology and how our surroundings build us as people and how we adapt to the families we're in and the people who bring us up and how we kind of take on ideas from other people. And, you know, Dogtooth, which was his kind of big breakthrough film, is, you know, very much that film about the family who are keeping their daughters in confinement and giving them a kind of alternative descriptions of life and the present and society. And then sort of in the end, they're kind of thrown out into the real world. And it's kind of like, I think the similarities between Dogtooth and Poor Things are really fascinating. Yeah, Dogtooth is a much, as you say, it's a much darker and bleaker film than this one. But this is kind of almost showing, what if we used that same formula, but showed a slightly different side to it? I think one interesting thing about the ending also, you know, Hannah, you talked about the happy ending of the film. Yeah, I've seen a lot of critics talk about this ending and how it made them feel. And yeah, some people have said it's too happy. And I think that there were enough elements of this film of like fantasy and projection and you not necessarily needing to take the actual actions on screen like very literally. And, you know, we're inside Bella's head here. We're kind of experiencing things in a way. And there is all these intimations of dreams and fantasies in the film. And, you know, what it reminded me of, if you can remember, do you guys remember the ending of King of Comedy, where Rupert Pupkin is like performing in front of an audience and he's you know, is it a dream? Is it a fantasy? And I got this kind of element of that from Poor Things. Like it kind of gives you this little hint that like, you know, is this too happy to be real? So I think there's still this like element of darkness in there that he kind of just floats out very subtly.
Maybe she, you know, because when we meet Bella, or I mean, not Bella, she's Victoria Blessington when we first meet her. But maybe that opening scene is actually the film and everything else is a fantasy. You know, I like that. I like how I hadn't thought of it like that, but I like that idea.
Oh, you need to do one of those YouTube explained videos.
David does not need to do one of those YouTube explained videos.
But I mean, I just love this. And, you know, even more to get into in the magazine. I think we could talk for like the full hour, but we probably shouldn't. But yeah, let's get some scores on this. A spoiler alert for me, 5.55. Moving on. David, what about you? What is your in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I would say that probably I would go 4.55 on this one. I will admit that I've been a little bit mixed on some of Lanthimos' previous films. I had a hint of skepticism, even though I think that I was very excited to see Willem Dafoe and Hannah Schigler, Gerard Carmichael, and working with him on this book thing, and as well, like the literary source, the first film that he's made from an actual book, and you know, a classic book, a very weird book that you know, many people said couldn't really be adapted. So all those things seem very exciting for me. So yeah, it's a 4.55.
God, it's a bit like that meme for me of kind of like, you know, the man's getting more and more excited and his mind being blown, where it's like Yorgos Lanthimos, Gerard Carmichael, an unfilmable book, the marketing team is worried.
Yeah, that's the key. The marketing team is worried. That's how you know you've got a heater. When I heard like the marketing team for May December were a bit concerned, it was like, let's go. I don't know. I think I've seen this three times now, and I think I'd go maybe 5.45. Maybe that's a bit weird, but I mean, fuck it, that's how I feel. So Emma Stone is one of my all-time favorite actresses. She's probably the reason, or one of the reasons, I started writing about films, because I saw Easy A when I was like 15 and I was like, this woman is everything I would like to be in life. Yeah, I find her a hugely kind of inspiring figure creatively, and she's just so funny, like in this film, in The Curse, in interviews, she's just so charismatic. And I'm sad we didn't get to talk to her for the mag because of the strike, because I just think she's delightful and she's so talented, and I could have a podcast that's just me talking about how much I love Emma Stone. But yeah, wonderful picture.
Well, I mean, it's just such like a stacked week. It feels like a such a complex film about a young woman comes along every couple of months, and this week we've got two. So yeah, next up, it's Priscilla.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Through Priscilla's eyes, Sofia Coppola tells the unseen side of a great American myth in Elvis and Priscilla's long courtship and turbulent marriage, from a German army base to his Dreamworld estate at Graceland. But first up, I spoke to cinematographer Philippe Lesourd on bringing this complex vision to screen. It's so lovely to meet you. I was just reading a full book on Sofia Coppola by Hannah Strong. Yeah, you know, it's fascinating to hear your words in that.
Yeah, it's very nice. You know, I discovered the book a month ago. So it's very nice to see, you know, all these pictures and Marie Antoinette, Lost in Translation, the film I didn't do, but it's very, you know, and all the interpretation or all of film and all research. That's very beautiful to see that.
But you've first worked with her on The Beguiled, is that right? Or had you collaborated?
Yeah, that's right. I worked before, on a few months before. I work on commercial with her, but I work on La Traviata, an opera she directed.
And then, like, instantly, like, what do you think it was that you both, like, connected with in each other that you wanted to continue this collaboration?
Me on my side, because I love a movie, so I knew it was something very important. And also, it was interesting when you meet some people like Sofia, that she has a knowledge of cinema, and she has a strong idea of edit and a number of shots she wants to. If you see a movie, she makes strong decision about, you know, how many shots for the scene, and that stay. On all the film I work with her, she don't cover a lot of setup on the scene, because it's a mix of the budget, of the number of days, the number of scenes you have to shoot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this one we shoot on 30 days, with you know, is nothing compared, you know, for the number of scenes. So she have a strong idea about, you know, I want to stay with Priscilla, and that my main goal. So I'm not going to cover everything. So, and that's the beauty of a film. You know, you are not, you know, you don't have, you know, crane shot and Steadicam and 200, you know, close up and detail and pick up is one shot. And that's a strong commitment.
Yeah, I mean,
for a director.
I mean, the way it stays with Priscilla, but it also stays so much of it within this, like, you know, like a beautiful prison of Graceland. I mean, how was it kind of capturing what the kind of sense of that home, of that, like, estate would be?
Because a main goal, when we talk about Priscilla, it was about Because I ask, but I forget exactly the word she described to me. And when I started to read the script, I said, can you describe in one word the film? I will need to ask her again, but it was something about femininity or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's why my goal as a cinematographer, but I think it's a different word, but she described on one word. And after it become how intimate you want to be with a character. And it's always a question for her, is who's looking this scene? So if it's about Priscilla, we are with Priscilla. And they have a number of scenes, and we don't cover anybody else. It's about her. So that, you know, a strong statement when you shoot that. But it's also, you have to bring some magic. You know, you arrive in Graceland, you need to bring some magic. And what world? She's coming from Germany. And this world was very, you know, in Germany, you know, you try to imagine, you know, end of 50s, you know, with gray and dark, and all the color are brown, green, compared to suddenly Graceland is full of colors, the car are fantastic, the design is completely different. So you know, it's a chaos between these two worlds, and suddenly Graceland has become the sun, but it's become a prison. But she didn't know that.
I mean, one of the scenes that I just absolutely adored is the one with the fireworks, and like just how like you can kind of really like it hits you in the heart of like how magical a moment of like that would be. I mean, what was the kind of key to capturing that?
When you read the scene, you know, it was very simple. Mm. It was a fireworks, they play again, you know, the gang is playing again, and they kiss each other in silhouette. That was a goal. So for Sophia, she's very shy over in general. And always on the script, and the kiss is always in silhouette. It's always being writing a specific scene on the screen. So we knew how we handled. It was very something romantic about that. Sophia, she's very romantic. So she loves the idea of the first love and the true love. So that was, you know, it's a mix of joy and excitement, but also connection for the first time.
Is that, I mean, like on a less kind of romantic, is there any like practical difficulties that actually come in simply because you have a lead actress who is, you know, very small and acting against, I think, what is Jacob Elordi, something like 6'5" or something?
Yeah. It was the first question, even before I received the script. It was the first question from Sophia. Yeah, do you have any problem, you know, when we shoot with a different eye to them? I didn't know it was Jacob. So, no, you put, yes, it's for sure is more complicated, but he helped the story in the same time. He helped, you know, to have a, you know. And, you know, you use something very, you know, easy. You know, you put, you know, apple box, and sometimes she was wearing, you know, bigger shoes when we don't see her foot.
It does feel, watching it, that there's like a huge amount of like trust in Kaylee, because so often the camera is so fixed on her. It's so close to her. It's so intimate to her. Was part of like creating the intimacy, like also like, you know, physically having the camera being like within her proximity.
But it's also, yes, for sure, because you could shoot, you know, close up in such a different way. You shoot, you know, wide lens, mid, and longer lens. And if you have a camera, you know, 20 centimeters from your face, you know, with a wide lens, or, you know, or something compared to your eyes with more about 40, 50, or something with a longer lens, I think emotion, you know, when I did all the tests with this camera, I tried large format, you know, normal camera. And I found, for example, the large format will give me a different distance between the actor and with the lens I used to work. So I found I need to find the right combination for the actor to be, you know, not too close, but on the right distance. So you feel intimate with them. The choice of the lens was very important, because you need to find something very delicate and sensible about her character. So I went for this type of ultra speed from Panavision to give this sense on something very fragile about life and love.
We have a huge amount of footage, obviously, of Priscilla and of Elvis from the time. Were there any images of them that you saw of them in real life that kind of informed the way that you wanted this to look?
As a referent, I saw a lot of on footage, Super 8. I tried to understand what connection these two characters have. So that I think that was the goal. Even, you know, the Super 8 footage, you know, you can find online, that's very fun. But I tried to, you know, what was the connection? And that was the goal. But I think it's about, you know, for Sophia was, you know, so loneliness of this character, the jail, the jail, or she's golden cage.
It's also just kind of made so much sadder given that Lisa Marie's passed, and like, so even like those like beautiful scenes where she's got her new baby, now they've got like...
That's very sad. You know, when I learned the story, that was very sad, because you remember, you know, he's a character, you shoot a baby and this baby is passing away, you know. You know, later on
life,
I find that quite very sad.
It's one of the most beautiful moments in the film, I think, to me, when she's, you know, going to the hospital to have her baby, but of course she has to look perfect and, like, you know, be so beautiful. But yeah, I think that there's something beautifully feminine and sweet about that moment.
Yes. I think also she, especially Priscilla, and it was very difficult for her. You know, she started, you know, on the morning at 14, and she's pregnant, you know, 2 days later, and she divorced, you know, 1 day later every day. So emotionally, it was something very fascinating to see the transformation of an actress. And you know, some moments are very emotional for us as a technician to be on set, to be because I operate the camera and to watch it in front of your eyes. So it's very beautiful to see that, to be able to catch that.
It's such a convincing aging process, was one of the things I just found so remarkable, of like, she really does look 14 when she's 14. Yeah. And, you know, by the end, you kind of do believe this is a fully grown woman. Is there anything that's being done from a cinematography point of view to kind of help her mature?
You have a fantastic actress in front of you, you follow.
God, that's even...
No, of course, you have a question about age. I think he has to come from her. You don't want, you know, to trick and post-production and special effect that you, oh, she has to look younger, or she has to look older, you know, with makeup and prosthetic. I think it's about performance. You know, when I shot The Grandmaster, it was the film with Wong Kar-wai, it was a question to age the actor or not. And we never did it. He's passing 15 years on the film, and we never use any trick. It's about dialogue, emotion.
I mean, it's such a beautiful film, but I think, beside kind of learning about Priscilla's story and kind of putting this out to the world, is there something that you are particularly proud of in terms of a moment in it?
I think probably the beginning, the first scene on the bar, and the two last scene at the end. The last scene when she leaves, you make you cry at the end, and right. She's on the car.
Yeah.
And her separation on Las Vegas bedroom. I love this scene.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene. It's such a beautiful film. I've seen it twice. I can't wait to see it again.
But
thank you so much for your time. Same, and I don't want to unlove it. Like, maybe I'll just let the memory be preserved in amber. So, Hannah, you literally wrote the book on Sofia Coppola. I mean, what are the sort of Sofia signatures that you think Priscilla has?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I heard that this was a story she was going to be adapting from Priscilla's memoir, Elvis and Me, it seemed like a very natural fit. I think at first I did wonder if it was going to be too similar to My Antoinette, which also has this thing of a young woman at 14 meeting this huge figure and ending up being swept away in this life of luxury and madness, and learning how to kind of toe the line and how to kick back against the line on occasion. And I think that Sofia has always been interested in the kind of dark side of fame, or not even like the dark side of fame, but just the kind of aspects of fame that she may have struggled with herself growing up in such a famous family, and also the realities of being a young woman trying to grow up in that environment. Because as a young woman, you know, we kind of discussed it already, but you know, you're forced to exist under very strenuous circumstances a lot of the time, and I think that only increases when you're in the public eye, as you know, there's a lot of good things that come from that, and I would love to have Priscilla's wealth, but, you know, I think growing up from being a teenager under such public scrutiny must have been incredibly difficult. And I think that that is one of the things that Sophia has always been interested in exploring on screen. So I was very excited. I think it's definitely a story that was in her wheelhouse, and it was just a kind of matter of if she could do it in a way that would feel sufficiently different from her other films, or if not sufficiently different, just kind of interesting. You know, I think she's a filmmaker who knows what films she makes, and she makes them exceedingly well. And I think that she's very unique in that way for a kind of female filmmaker, because I think this runs across all art that women make. There's sometimes this expectation for you to reinvent yourself every single time, particularly in pop music. Female artists are expected to have a new persona every time they release a new album in a way that I think men maybe aren't held to that standard. Obviously someone like David Bowie is an example of someone who did that of his own accord. But yeah, I mean, no one's going to look at Christopher Nolan making Oppenheimer and go, oh, I can't believe he's making another film about a tortured white man. You know, so it seems a bit weird that people would have that criticism of Sofia Coppola. But yeah, I was excited. As always, she was working under the kind of difficulties of trying to make an independent film, a truly independent film, when the industry is not that hospitable to it anymore, if it's ever been. And working with Kaylee Spaney, who was kind of an unknown in such a big role, I think, you know, kind of was probably another thing that made it challenging for her to kind of get financing and things on board. But she pulled it off, God bless her. And I think that after On the Rocks, which was maybe a little bit of a disappointment for me, I mean, I like the film, but I think it's maybe not as strong as her other films. This was like such a welcome return to form, I think, in terms of the craft of the film and the kind of approach that she takes, because coming to a person that everyone knows, everyone has a perception of in popular culture, is, you know, it's always going to be such a challenge. But the way that I think she handles Priscilla is so delicate and so sensitive without kind of feeling like it's just hagiography trying to kind of like shame the spirit of Elvis Presley or something. I think it's a very even-handed attempt to say something about not only their relationship but kind of power dynamics between men and women, particularly with age gaps, and also just, yeah, the kind of hoops that you have to jump through as a woman in the 50s and 60s, as a woman now. I think that it's such a beautifully balanced film is how I would describe it. And I just loved being in this world. I always think of her films as being so tactile, and you just kind of, you don't just like watch it, you kind of live in it for like 90 minutes. And I think this is kind of a beautiful example of that. She very much like Yorgos, just always assembles the most talented group of creatives to work with, from Philippe Lesourd to Stacey Batter, who did the costumes, which are just incredible in this film. I think, yeah, that she is a real person who cares about every single detail you're seeing on that camera, on that screen, and if it's not perfect, it's not going to be on there. So yeah, that's my very long-winded way of saying I really like this film.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful film, and it's so kind of committed to, like, I think something quite truthful about Priscilla's experience, where like we don't shy away from the difficulty and the sort of abusive elements and the kind of difficult power dynamics that she eventually broke free on. But like, it admits that like Elvis Presley showing up when you're a teenager and sweeping you away to his like giant estate in, you know, in Memphis would feel magical a lot of the time. And like that, to kind of deny that and to kind of do a Elvis bad actually would have been, I think, such a terrible betrayal of her story. But David, I'm curious, I mean, like, obviously last year Elvis was like a huge hit, both like financially and at least got a lot of nominations. Like, you think this is sort of helped or hindered by the fact that we've had these kind of two perspectives so close together?
Well, I mean, I think one of Priscilla's major strengths is it sells itself as a biopic, or not sells itself, but presents as a biopic, you know, a real life subject. It's based on a memoir. Its main strength is that it kind of doesn't follow the same kind of conventions and same route as most traditional biopics. The sort of biographical film, the biopic, is one of my least favorite sort of subgenres. I mean, I find it very pointless. You know, when I watch these films, what I'm thinking is that they've been made because they come part and parcel with a very strong marketing hook and a pre-existing audience. I find that these films have to work even harder to sort of justify themselves as being more than just kind of cash-ins on, you know, delivering something to some people who already exist and who already want it. So, I mean, Elvis, for me, seemed to sort of do that. And I think there's been, like, in this award season in particular, there's been some good, really good biopics and some not so good ones. And I think that, like, this kind of sits in a bracket with something like Ferrari for me, in that Priscilla and Ferrari are films where I think the makers have actually things they want to say beyond the subject matter, and they're trying to talk more broadly about the world and love and, you know, men and women and fame and business and all these really interesting subjects. I mean, you know, I'm being very broad when I'm talking about them here, but and I think in the film in Priscilla, it's much more kind of nuanced about what they're saying. Whereas, like, you have films like Elvis and maybe something like Bradley Cooper's Maestro as well. The issue with Bradley Cooper's Maestro is it's desperately trying to make a profound statement about the person, about Leonard Bernstein. We need to say something about him and his genius. And I think that that idea and going into a film with that as your brief is always going to be a hiding to nothing, because you cannot, you know, we cannot really say profound things about people because, you know, people are just mysterious and we never truly know. And it's just going to come across as weird, I think. And Sofia Coppola, I think, in this film, although I think there's definitely a kind of profound respect for Priscilla Presley, her trials and the strange relationship she had with Elvis, I never really felt that she's putting her on a pedestal. She's in love with her. She wants to exonerate her for something, or even though it is giving her side of the story, it never felt like, as you say, this isn't the kind of Elvis Evil Actually film. It's like, it's a very kind of, you know, not ambivalent, but just it's more kind of even-handed in how it presents the sort of relative merit, pros and cons of people's decisions, and it's just far more interesting for it. I mean, my memory of it, maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but like, I think the sort of vast majority of the films occurs with Elvis and Priscilla in bed, just sort of talking and having these kind of strange interactions. Some of them sort of sexual, but others, it's the bedroom is this kind of sanctum where they have they do their kind of important discussions about what their relationship is going to be like. And I really got a sense of, like, you know, reminded me of something like a film I absolutely love, The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kent, the Fassbinder film, which all takes place in a single apartment. And you get that, you get that sense of claustrophobia. And that film is all about the kind of the micro power plays between these people and how the kind of balance of power in a relationship just is constantly fluctuating. You know, there is a sort of dom and sub almost style vibe to that film. And I think it sort of seeps through into Priscilla as well, where you kind of, it's all about, like, who has got the kind of, who's holding the cards. And in this case, it's often Elvis in the end, because of his status and his fame, it allows him to have these decisions. But it feels very kind of, it's fascinating to see how, what Priscilla does and how she kind of manages this situation. As you say, it's not presented as, like, Graceland is not this kind of dark, haunted house full of horrible people. I mean, there are some horrible people there, and she doesn't have, you know, there are elements of it that where she doesn't have a great time, but she loves it as well. I mean, it's almost, I'm watching The Sopranos at the moment, and I'm seeing The Sopranos everywhere. And even with this, I think there's almost a bit of a kind of Carmela, Tony vibe to the relationship of, like, you know, what are the reasons that we're in this relationship for? Like, why are we doing this? So, yeah,
they were called the Memphis Mafia, you know, his acolytes.
Well, there you go. So, you know, there is that connection. But, you know, he has got that thing of, like, you know, he's venerated in the same way as Tony Soprano, while his flaws are quite obvious for all to see. But you can't, you know, nobody can really talk about them. But yeah, no, I think within the Sofia Coppola canon, this is definitely one of her strongest films. I love Marie Antoinette. I love The Bling Ring. I haven't actually watched Lost in Translation since I saw it when it came out. So that's a kind of long time rewatch opportunity. I'm a bit nervous, but I remember loving it when it came out.
Same, and I don't want to unlove it. like maybe I'll just let the memory be preserved in amber.
I mean, I as someone who obviously spent a lot of time with that film and with her films generally whilst I was writing the book, I do think Lost in Translation is one of those films that there are great things about it, but it's very much, she was however old, like 30 when she made that film, and I think that she has matured so much as a person. And even though, you know, stylistically there's still definitely, you know, it's, you can tell it's the same filmmaker, but I think her ideas and her understanding of the world have kind of developed so much since then, which is just the nature of growing up, you know, and understanding how the world works. There's some stuff in that film that has not aged well. There's a lot of kind of racial stuff that, by her own admission, she says, I thought it was fine. You know, and that comes from that perspective of being a very rich white girl who grew up in a very insulated environment and wasn't talking to people. So, I mean, maybe that's another reason she related to Priscilla. There's an interesting criticism I've seen of the film where people kind of say, oh, well, I didn't really feel like I knew her at the end of it. And I'm like, I mean, A, what's our right to ever know another person, especially a celebrity? And B, I don't think that's necessarily what motivates her filmmaking. I think she's a very mysterious person, even having now met her finally after all these years. I don't think she's someone who ever gives away more than she is comfortable with. And I think having been in the spotlight for such a long time, she's developed quite a strong sense of how much or how little that is going to be. And I think that Priscilla is not a film that is trying to make you understand who Priscilla Presley is, or, you know, kind of give us this like great insight into her mindset. I think, like David says, it's making much kind of wider commentary or a wider kind of bringing up wider questions, which I think is more interesting anyway. But also on the kind of subject of Elvis, because I think Jacob Elordi is like really brilliant in this film, and I think in a lesser performer's hands it could have been a very like silly performance and a very kind of over the top, very caricature performance of Elvis, but actually he does this really quite remarkable thing where you understand the kind of immense power and charisma that he had, but also you do understand the kind of, he had kind of been through the same thing as Priscilla, in that he was very young when he became so famous and was so kind of coddled and restricted that he grew up under such kind of rules and restrictions, especially from Colonel Tom Parker, that he is in this kind of state of arrested development. And at some point she outpaces him in that she realizes, you know, I don't need to live in your world. I don't need to play by your rules. I am capable of being my own person away from you. And he can't really come to terms with that. And I think that is the great tragedy here, is that she becomes this person who is not able to get what she needs emotionally from him. And, you know, there's a beautiful scene where they're in the back of a car in Las Vegas, and we'd seen them at the beginning of the film going to Vegas for the first time, and it's this great moment of romance, and then we see them silently sitting side by side, and he's smoking this big cigar, and he's got his like classic Elvis jumpsuit like thing on and his sunglasses, and it's just this moment where you can see the realization has like dawned on her that she doesn't have to live like this, but he does. Like, you know, he can't break out of whatever this is, and we all know how that kind of story ends. We've all seen the other Elvis film.
Do we know? I've heard some conspiracies.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's now
maybe
living
not at
in,
this point
living in yeah, on some island working for the CIA or whatever the conspiracy theory was.
We should get some points on this absolutely lovely film. David, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
No, I've seen it once, so I probably need to see it again to have a fuller picture, but I'm probably going to give it like 4s across the board. I think on a different week it might have been 5s, but just compared to Poor Things, I think it's a more delicate and refined film. And yeah, I'm big into Sofia Coppola, and I quite liked On the Rocks, and I loved The Beguiled. So yeah, I've pretty much gone through her entire filmography there. So I mean, the film, I understand, has been a, you know, pretty decent success so far, and I hope Kaylee does get on some awards ballots somewhere, because I think it is a really remarkable performance by her. And I don't know what you guys think about this, but it's like, I think that you maybe have to work a little bit harder to see the qualities of her performance, but they're definitely there. And by that I mean she's working on quite a sort of subtle plane of kind of withholding and reacting to situations in a way that isn't kind of big melodrama Oscar clip type moment. So, but I think that sort of nuance is really difficult, especially for a performer who's so young and I guess relatively inexperienced. So yeah, I think she's going to be huge.
Which is ironic because she's so tiny.
Going to fight aliens, isn't she?
Yeah, she's got Alien and Civil War, Alex Garland's new film with Kirsten Dunst this year. So I can see her being poised for huge things. We also spoke to her for the website, and she is a delightful human being, so smart and so switched on, and seems to genuinely care about filmmaking, which is not always a given in this industry nowadays. So yeah, no, I wish her all the success. I think, yeah, it's such a subtle performance. It's not a big showy awards performance, which is maybe why she's kind of a little bit under the radar as well. But I think, yeah, I think she's really great in it. And her and Jacob have such like good chemistry, because the film is really just, it's, there are other characters, but it is mostly them having conversations and them having moments. So I think, you know, it really does rely on that kind of two-hander chemistry, and they definitely have it.
Well, given that they have such great chemistry, your scores, I imagine, are going to be pretty great, true?
Yeah, I think 4, 5, 5, maybe. I've seen it 3 times now, same as Poor Things, and I think I'd quite happily watch it again. I mean, there's so much we didn't even have time to get into here. I mean, the music and everything, like, I think, yeah, it's just, yeah, Sophia, I think, is kind of a divisive filmmaker. She has a lot of fans, but she also has a lot of people who can't get on board with her, much like Wes Anderson, I think, because she does what she does in her style. And if you don't like it at this point, it's kind of like, well, I think maybe you just don't like the filmmaker. But, you know, maybe there are some converts who've only come to her off the back of Priscilla. But I think, yeah, 4, 5, 5, I really love this film. And I think it's very special, and I feel very protective of it, because I think it challenges so much about our ideas of like celebrity biopics and kind of what a biopic needs to be or needs to do.
Yeah, I think I'm probably was a 4 coming into it. There's always a slight bit of me that is wary when a biopic has been made in close collaboration with the subject themselves. But you know, that wasn't, you know, there was nothing to worry about in that regard, because I think you said earlier, like, this film doesn't kind of put Priscilla onto like a pedestal, a bit like, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody, where they go like, hey, what if we do, and like, and then they pretend we will rock you. Nothing as silly as that. Probably a 5 in enjoyment. Some of that does come down to sitting behind a pair of journalists at the first screening, and one of them turning to the other and saying, do you think Elvis is going to be in this? And the other one looked at them incredulously and said, like, what, do you think it's all going to be about what happened on the set of Naked Gun? Every time. So I was kind of lightly tittering throughout all of that, and I had the most wonderful time. Yeah, probably a 4 in retrospect. I think it could go up to a 5. Just feels a bit unfair to give out 2 5s in 1 week, but I really couldn't recommend it enough. And it has been very nice that a lot of non-film nerdy friends have been asking me about this one, so I think it's going to do pretty well. Before we say farewell to our listeners, we've got our one last thing. You guys are going to give us some non-movie recommendations. David, do you want to go first? What is the non-movie that you suggest people seek out this week after seeing these 2 masterpieces, of course?
At the beginning of the year, I tend to kind of get on a little bit of a tip of reading a novel that is potentially going to kind of turn into a film, a bit of deep research. And I was kind of over Christmas looking at things incoming, and there was a tweet that I saw that suggested that the next Paul Thomas Anderson film, which was going to star Leonardo DiCaprio, was going to be another adaptation of Thomas Pynchon, the elusive American novelist. And he's already made Inherent Vice, and the suggestion was he was going to do another one of his novels, which is like an 80s set novel called Vineland. And so, yeah, I'm sort of deep into reading Thomas Pynchon's Vineland, and it's really good. Like, his stuff is very, very kind of tripped out, wackadoo, conspiracy within conspiracy, you know, plot all over the place. Yeah, I'm having a really fun time reading that novel. Like, it's from the 80s, so you know, it's an oldie in many ways. I cannot see any way that this could be made into a film. There's like the way it's structured, it kind of has these weird concentric chapters where you kind of get to a point, and then you kind of go back and see how they got to that point, and then you kind of follow a different character. There's no main character. It's just kind of like thingy corpse, exquisite corpse.
Exquisite corpse.
type.
You should
type,
know that.
Yeah, you should know that. Yeah, it's like an exquisite corpse type structure where you kind of like every chapter is a sort of like goes on a it doesn't follow continuously from the story of the previous chapter, but kind of picks a detail and kind of goes off in a different direction. So, I mean, it might even be a conspiracy that PTA is even doing this film. I mean, God knows, you know, what it would look like and who would see it. But it's been really fun reading that. So that's my kind of weird non-film thing.
So I've kind of had a bit of an inadvertent parallel with you, because I just read Blood Meridian, which they've announced that they're going to try and adapt again. Not
I'll
really
believe
sure
it
how.
When I see it. Burned by that one before.
I think several people, but one
James
of the most...
Franco.
Yes,
dodged
that was
a bullet
I was
there.
Say.
Dodged a
yeah,
bullet.
One of the most cursed potential adaptations of all time was that at one point James Franco was going to make it, and you know, starring Dave Franco. So, when it looks bad out of the window, and when you turn on the news, just think how much worse it could have been. Hannah, what about you? What is your non-movie recommendation this week?
Well, the thing I want to recommend actually ends on Friday when this goes out, so I feel a bit bad recommending it. The first thing I will mention, though, is Annie Baker's Infinite Life, which will be finishing its run at the National Theatre on Friday. I'm sorry, everyone. I can't get you tickets, but if it comes back or anything, if you have a chance to see it somewhere else, it's really wonderful. It's quite a short play. I think it's just under 2 hours, and it's about these women and a man, but mainly these women who are at a pain management clinic in Northern California, and it's just a lot of kind of conversations that they're having about their pain and about their lives. And it's so kind of simple in premise, but I found it so kind of profoundly moving and unexpectedly so. I wasn't expecting to be as kind of struck by it emotionally as I was. And I think that Annie Baker's someone who we're probably going to be hearing a lot more about, although she's kind of already very well known within the playwriting and theatre community. Her first film, Janet Planet, Janet Planet. I always want to say Planet Janet in the kind of voice of Damn It Janet. But she's made her first film, which apparently is very, very good, according to Charles Romesco, Our Man in New York. So I really, really, really want to watch that now, because I just think she's such a kind of clear-eyed writer and so observant and so funny. And yeah, I could just kind of sing her praises till cows come home. But the other recommendation I will give, since that has finished, is I went to see Ryuichi Sakamoto's live VR show, which is going on at the moment. Obviously, he passed away last year, but this is kind of a posthumous performance of this show, Kagami, which is you're given a kind of VR headset and you keep that on, and he is projected in front of you at the piano, and you see him give this sort of 50-minute performance of his kind of greatest hits. And there's kind of these visuals which come in of kind of snow falling and leaves and everything. And this is at the Roundhouse in Camden. But it first premiered at Manchester. Anyway, it will probably be doing the rounds for a while, probably travelling around a bit. Yeah, I only went because I was covering it for the BBC. And actually, I was surprised again at how moving I found it. The technology is far from perfect. You know, I think VR is kind of still in its sort of infancy. And you do notice the cracks. You can kind of walk up to the piano and like look, and if you get close up to where Sakamoto is sat, you can see he looks a bit like a sim from the computer game. It's a bit kind of uncanny valley. But the music is just fantastic. And I guess it's, you know, he was such an embracer of technology and such a kind of curious person who really saw the potential in how technology could move us forward as a people, but also the kind of risks that come with that and the threat that comes with that. And I think it's a very special thing to kind of hear that music in a kind of group of like 20 people. It's quite an intimate setting. It's definitely worth checking out if you get the chance. It's on like 3 or 4 times a day at the moment at the Roundhouse. It's not very long. And yeah, it's definitely kind of food for thought. And the music, you know, I mean, hearing that kind of theme from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, I think I defy anyone to not kind of tear up at that. It's just such a beautiful piece of music. And yeah, kind of put me in my feelings about you know, kind of death, which is such a nice note to end on. I'm ending how I started this episode.
Yeah, and all of the ways in which I was made happy throughout it has now been entirely drained from me at the thought that I did try and fail to get tickets to the Annie Baker, someone I love so much that I actually do just read her plays for fun when I'm down. And Janet Planet still doesn't have a UK release date, so
I know. Despair.
This is worse than this is worse than the final act of Blood Meridian. But yes, thank you both so much for your recommendations, and we will be back soon. Next time, Christmas is coming very late on Alexander Payne's tragicomedy, The Holdovers, and David spoke to the director. James Daniels has an audacious take on the Messiah in Book of Clarence, while for Film Club, we'll be revisiting 1979's Being There. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth in Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif. My guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and was edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.